Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The cars are maybe more fuel efficient than in past years, but they are already pulling out of Washington as the Senate follows the House to August recess. Yesterday, senators approved the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor for the U.S. Supreme Court. They also passed a measure to provide another $2 billion to the Cash for Clunkers program, but still on the to-do list, the health care bill. For a little roundup, Gail Chadwick, the congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, joins us. And Gail, you're the one who told us about this traditional sighting of exiting cars. So who still is working?
Really, health care is top of mind for every member of the House and Senate over this break, especially for the Senate, because all of the work has been done on the House panels. They're just waiting to see what happens in the last committee, which is the Senate Finance Committee, and in particular, just six members of that committee, three Democrats and three Republicans, who have kind of had a cone of silence over their deliberations for months now.
Well, that's the name of Max Baucus, Montana, Kent Conrad, North Dakota, Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico, Mike Enzi of Wyoming, these are on the Republican side, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, Olympia Snow of Maine.
Very good.
Thank you. I have a list here.
Now, some of those names, especially on the Republican side, you've seen before. I think Olympia Snow has helped broker just about anything bipartisan that's moved for the last 10 years. She was a key player in ratcheting back the Bush tax cuts, much to the dismay of Republicans. And she's been a key player in, you know, slowing down some of the reining in the scope of some of the Obama plans as a key Republican vote there as well, to the dismay of Democrats. And what we're seeing now is a very interesting kind of drama going on, where the Finance Committee is reaching out to allies outside the committee. Today there was a report of the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce being solicited by the committee to just drum up support for these bipartisan negotiations. And people outside the committee, most notably Senator Rockefeller from West Virginia a couple days ago, revving up his supporters, especially on the issue of child health. Something like 150 groups sent a letter yesterday saying, we're very afraid that children are going to be hurt by what comes out of this bipartisan committee. So it's quite interesting. The press is already on to influence what is going on inside what is still really a black box.
Well, and there's a drama going on outside, as you well know, in town halls across the country as lawmakers try to meet with their constituents. We've seen angry protests. Of course, now the reports that some of these protests may have a template, a political action memo written by conservative activist Bob McGaughey of Connecticut. He defends himself on Alan Combs' radio program this week, saying he doesn't make people angry. They already are angry, but his memo urges people to cut off lawmakers before they can even speak, to go to these town hall meetings and almost try to stop the exchange of information. So the question is, how is this anger that we're seeing at these meetings resonating in Washington as senators head to their constituents? And might there be a backlash as we keep seeing these images now of people cutting off their lawmakers and not letting them have a conversation, even if there is genuine anger out there?
Absolutely right. I think this is an issue that the Democrats were all over, even before some of these images became daily occurrences. What they're doing is advising their members to create a different kind of town hall, an electronic town hall, for example, where you cannot create the image that is so scary to politicians. The only thing worse than a perp walk, you know, with handcuffs and bright lights, is to be standing there with an out-of-control crowd looking like a doe in the headlights. And in that sense, anything that will get them out of that kind of visual image is all to the good. What it's not good for is basic democracy.
Right.
These few weeks are so important for members to be in contact with their constituents, actually hear what they have to say, and vice versa.
That's Gail Chad, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We will see what happens over the coming weeks as lawmakers do go home and meet with their constituents, either, as you say, online or in town hall meetings. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
The Reinvention Convention. That's the title of the National Association of Black Journalists annual meeting going on in Florida this week. and reinvention is needed. Just like mainstream media, African-American publications and media outlets are struggling. Fans of Ebony and Jet, two of the oldest black magazines, are urging friends not to cancel their subscriptions. But despite more than 2 million subscribers, owner Johnson Publications has had to mortgage its historic Chicago building. Minority broadcasters have asked the Treasury Secretary for what amounts to a temporary bailout. And here in Massachusetts, the longtime African-American newspaper, the Bay State Banner, closed until it received a bridge loan from the city of Boston. During that time, it missed one of the biggest race-related stories of the year, the arrest of Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr. So where are we on African-American media? Let's start with Kai Wright. He's senior writer for TheRoot.com, a webzine focused on black politics and culture, which is published by The Washington Post. And by the way, its editor-in-chief is Henry Louis Gates. Kai, what's the meaning to you of refresh, reinvent, and reclaim? That's the slogan of the convention.
Well, I don't know. I can't speak for them, but I can say that, black journalists, like many journalists, are besieged right now. I mean, there's this overwhelming anxiety about the future. And will we have jobs? Will we be relevant? That's both inside and outside of the black press. So this is, for probably the last few years of the NABJ convention, which is, it's a big deal. I mean, thousands of journalists from all over the country come. And the overwhelming conversation in the hallway has always been for the last few years, where are we going?
Right.
What are we going to do? How are we going to, do we have jobs?
Well, you talk about some of the reasons, the economy, and the same reasons that impact mainstream publications. But we are understanding that one difference may be, according to at least one analysis, that black publications rely more on the auto industry and that multicultural budgets at places like the auto industry are being slashed.
Yeah, I mean, I think usually there's only so big a pie for advertising to minorities, period, right? Whether it's black, Latino, and the pie doesn't grow, it just shifts around.
Mm-hmm.
And publishers that are working in black publications talk about having to compete now with the fact that people think the money is in, if you're going to spend your ethnic advertising dollars, you're going to spend it on Latinos.
Well, because that's a growing population.
Right.
Well, and you've said that there are really two conversations to be had about the minority media. We were just talking about magazines, Ebony, Jet, owned by Johnson Publications. But what's the other part?
Well, I mean, there's these national publications that have been around for years and that everyone knows. And then there's the local media. There's the local newspapers that have an equally vibrant history but have been troubled for some time now. And I actually believe they have an even more vital role in terms of the actual substantive thing that journalism has to offer to the world. They are the sorts of publications that can and are positioned to talk about things that don't rise to the daily newspaper, don't rise to the daily newscast, and certainly don't make national news, but are deeply relevant to the lives of black communities, And I think that those publications have been in real trouble for a real long time. There's hundreds of them still around the country, but many of them operate as, a single publisher, a single person working as the publisher, the editor, the reporter, and the news hole in their publications is smaller and smaller and increasingly not offering any value, which is a shame because they can be and have a long history of providing great value. And I don't know what we do about filling that.
Well, and as you well know, there's an argument as to whether or not it should be filled by government. In other words, whether or not some of these publications should be helped in the way that Boston has reached out. It's a loan that the city is making to the Bay State Banner, because the argument is, well, if this means so much to the African-American community, then they should support it. But what we just heard you say is part of the reason that it does mean so much is that they don't hear news about their communities in other places.
I think it's pretty demonstrable that there is a news hole. That's particularly when you talk about local news and local information relevant to black neighborhoods, just doesn't make it into the daily newspaper more and more frequently. Now, how do you fill that? Does the government pay for this? I mean, there is a growing conversation that beyond black media, the press in general, that the government should bail out the news. It's a conversation that a year ago I would have thought would have been absurd to hear, and now I think I hear people have making credible arguments. So I don't know where I come down on it, but it's a reflection of how desperate we all are to find a solution.
And these are the local newspapers and news. What about the magazines? Describe the roles that magazines such as Ebony, a monthly, and Jet, a weekly, play in the African-American community?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they used to be this place where it was the only place on a national scale you could get everything from culture to society, where if you wanted to be an aspirational middle-class black person, you could turn to this and identify it with it in some way. Or, to critics, if you wanted to ignore all of the problems outside your door, you could turn to this for that purpose. But they're cultural touchstones. I mean, one of the things, so I'm 35, folks my age and under now quite often sneer at some of these brands as outdated and old and crotchety. But, you know, the thing is that in order to have a brand that everybody sneers at, you've got to have a brand that has touched everybody's life in some way.
Well, and then I guess the other question is, you know, how much can nostalgia help the magazines going forward? I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Christopher Smith is a professor of communications at the University of Southern California. He joins us from USC's studios there. And Professor Smith, you've been hearing from Kai Wright of Root.com. Kai's around 35. I'm not going to ask your age, but ask your thoughts on, I guess, the question we're getting at is the relevance of the national African-American magazines and the newspapers. Two separate questions.
Well, thank you for having me. And I am around Kai's age, just a little bit older.
Okay.
And I think that the question of relevance for national magazines like Ebony and Jet really comes down to the increasing class fragmentation of the black community, and that there are fewer and fewer stories and ideas and trends that the entire African-American community rallies around univocally. As the Henry Louis Gates event and its aftermath indicate, the black community is now riven, productively so, I think, with a lot of different perspectives on just what the black community is.
Well, I was going to say, you say productively riven. And we've been talking to a lot of young African-Americans who say kind of sheepishly, well, no, my mother read Ebony or Jet, but I get my information online. I mean, is a part of what's happening that, first of all, African-Americans are not a monolith, but secondly, there's generational differences, just like there are in other communities?
Yes, I think the generational differences are very real. As Kai mentioned, I think Ebony and Jet really emerged in that post-World War II era when black Americans coming out of World War II were just beginning to feel a little bit that they could be part of the mainstream. And Ebony and Jet spoke to that mainstreaming aspirational aspect. But now you have a whole post-affirmative action generation who now don't really feel the need to pay homage to those touchstones the same way the previous generations did.
That's communications professor Christopher Smith, who teaches at the University of Southern California. Also with us, Kai Wright, senior writer for the webzine, TheRoot.com. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we want to ask them both about what they see in the future for African-American media and what we see in our future. Later today, a foodie and a film critic weigh in on Julie and Julia. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the challenges facing minority-owned and minority-focused media, and particularly African-American media. With us are communications professor Christopher Smith from the University of Southern California, and Kai Wright, senior writer for the African-American-focused webzine TheRoot.com. And Kai, we've heard from Professor Smith that some of the older legacy magazines, such as Ebony and Jet, are just a little bit out of touch for some readers. Is that because of editorial choices or less interest in reading things that are exclusively African-American? Or is it that young people in particular just want to do their reading online?
To some degree, these are the literally billion-dollar questions, right? I mean, to some degree, this is what everybody in media and even politics is trying to figure out, how to market what they've got to say to this new generation of people of all races, but particularly a multiracial America. And so to some degree, we don't know, right? But I think that it's clear that younger folks are not as interested in single silo understandings of the world. And so by that I mean, I think that if you're going to have a publication that is about race or that is about the black experience in America, it needs to approach that with less of a blunt tool. So what does that look like? Again, I don't know. But I think that people are less interested in having a single identity, a single perspective, a single experience. Young folks are comfortable with multiple identities and multiple walks of life.
In other words, they get to read Ta-Nehisi Coates' blog, which is very African-American centric, but then they can flip around and read another blog at the same sitting.
Or even within Ta-Nehisi's blog, it is written from the perspective of a young black man who lives in an urban area who is into hip-hop and poetry and politics, right? And that's it. It doesn't claim to be black stuff. It claims to be his experience, which cuts across many things.
Professor Smith, do you hear, though, in that? I can just hear someone's mother somewhere saying, yes, but if you forget about that, about the magazines that paved the way for you and remind you of your history, but also the issues that are important in the now, it'll be at your peril.
Well, I think that, again, Kai raises a good point. I don't think that this repository of history will be lost. I think that, for example, Ebony and Jet has just done a wonderful project where they've deposited every single issue of Jet, for example, on Google. So you can do a Google search and arrive at every single issue of Jet magazine through the years, see every photograph, every cover. And that's a tremendously valuable property, and that history will live on and have a tremendous legacy. I think, going back to Kai's point, how black-owned media will monetize the demand for that history such that they still lay ownership claim to it, that's still a big question, because the beauty of the web is also its curse for big media in that it drives the cost of bringing goods to market down to absolute zero.
Right. By the way, Professor Smith, we're talking about magazines more now, but Kai Wright, again of Root.com, he said that he felt that neighborhood print newspapers really served a necessary purpose because there's a hole when it comes to coverage of the African-American community and traditional news services. Do you think that's still true?
Well, on some level, yes. I think it's a matter of not that news pertaining to black neighborhoods and black communities is being left out. I think it's a matter of perspective. For example, when President Obama went to on his Africa trip and when he spoke to the NAACP, again, people found it remarkable that he could communicate certain messages to those audiences that perhaps a white diplomat or white statesperson could not. And so I think it's about just growing the number and the strength of black news practitioners, wherever they may be, so that they can bring that perspective into the broader mix.
Are you also saying that it's time to, move these journalists out of the neighborhood newspapers and into the main newsrooms? I guess this goes back to the question, do you think that those newspapers and magazines are still relevant, or should they aim for integrating into mainstream coverage?
Well, when the relevance question comes into play, I think there's no automatic reflex to being relevant. You have to earn your relevance every day when you're a business person. I find it quite amazing that there's an incredible growth story to be told when it comes to hyper-local, online-only entities. Community bloggers that blog about their housing project. They're doing essentially what pirate radio used to be 20, 30 years ago. And I think that that's a powerful story that is gradually going to emerge as one that we will be following even more than we'll be following whether these old entities are relevant or not.
But that happens in every community. Kai, I want you to go ahead and speak out, but I guess you're saying that the neighborhood newspapers will be relevant until the news of the neighborhood is covered in mainstream newscasts.
Yeah, I think I actually agree. The point I want to make is that substantive, day-to-day, thorough coverage of communities that are not middle class, of communities that are majority people of color, are things that just do not get as much consistent, meaningful coverage in the daily newspaper anymore. And the print black newspapers, the old print black newspapers, could fill that hole. They're not, in many cases, they're not filling it. They could. But if they don't, someone should.
That's Kai Wright. He's senior writer for Root.com, a webzine focused on black politics and culture, and a former neighborhood journalist yourself?
That's right.
Do you subscribe? What do you subscribe to? What do you read?
I read everything online.
Everything online. There you go. How about you, Christopher Smith, a professor of communications at the University of Southern California, who's been speaking to us from USC's studios there?
I still, quite honestly, am an Ebony and Jet subscriber, purely from a legacy perspective.
For nostalgia.
For nostalgia's sake. I'm an old school kind of guy. Interestingly enough, I also subscribe to a New York-based aspirational lifestyle magazine called Uptown. That's interesting because I see them kind of doing a kind of black town and country type thing. And that's what I mean when I see the black media consumer market kind of fragmenting into different pure plays that might create some opportunities for people to look into.
Right. A 21-year-old, an 18-year-old, a 15-year-old African-American might not be interested in that today.
No, yeah. But a well-capitalized 50-year-old might.
Yeah. Professor Smith, thanks so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And, of course, thanks, Kai Wright of TheRoot.com. So when we come back, we're going to hear from some of you after the news here and now. Her husband has been on the front pages for his private mission to North Korea, but Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is also on the road, making her way through Africa on a seven-nation tour. In South Africa today, she met with former President Nelson Mandela. The BBC's Jonah Fisher joins us from Johannesburg. And Jonah, today Secretary of State Clinton also called on South Africa's current government to press a reform in neighboring Zimbabwe. She said the chaos in Zimbabwe is creating a crisis for South Africa. Now, a reminder, in Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe is supposed to be sharing power with his rival, Morgan Tsvangirai. So what does the crisis there look like from South Africa?
The clear message coming from Hillary Clinton is that she doesn't believe that this power-sharing government in Zimbabwe is working, though there are many, and the South African government is one of them, who say that it's made significant strides over the last few months. This time last year, there was rampant hyperinflation and money really became worthless in Zimbabwe. Now this power-sharing government's in place. They've got rid of the Zimbabwe dollar. You now have foreign currencies being used, and that's helped stabilize things economically. I think what Hillary Clinton is really pushing for is saying that this power-sharing government doesn't yet convince them that it's actually about sharing power. They haven't seen those political reforms. They haven't seen the freedoms being reintroduced back into Zimbabwe's society, which convinced the United States that it's time to start considering developmental assistance, to consider removing the targeted sanctions still in place on senior figures in Zimbabwe.
But what can South Africa do? You mentioned the inflation in Zimbabwe. It once hit 500 billion percent, and as a result, there are 3 million refugees from Zimbabwe in South Africa, so they have a real interest in all of this. But do they really hold any cards in doing anything?
Well, South Africa is the biggest economy in Africa, so it is an important friend to Zimbabwe. Thabo Mbeki, of course, the previous president here, had a fairly long-standing policy here of not openly pushing for Robert Mugabe to leave office. So, yes, they do have a lot of power. They do have a lot of influence. I think they're also acutely aware, though, of the complex dynamics. South Africa is run by the African National Congress. It considers itself to be a liberation movement. And they see ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe in much the similar light. So they see comparisons between themselves. So that's in some way explains why they've been so reluctant in the past and still why they do remain quite reluctant to criticize Robert Mugabe or to call for ZANU-PF to step to one side.
Right, his party. Well, what about overall relations between the U.S. and South Africa? Hillary Clinton's counterpart in South Africa responded to a reporter's question, and she denied that there had been a chill between the two countries during the Bush administration, but said that Clinton might help improve relations. So obviously, improvement is needed.
Well, after the open affection that existed between President Mandela and President Clinton, Bill Clinton, it was inevitable that whatever followed was going to be a chill of some sort. It was a fairly open secret that the Bush administration were not happy with some of the policy decisions which the Mbeki administration here took on issues such as HIV and AIDS, denying the link between HIV and AIDS. So the hope is that now there's a new government in place here in South Africa, and Jacob Zuma, there's a new government in the United States, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Secretary of State. The hope here is certainly that things might warm up a bit and we might begin to approach the sort of level of friendship we saw when it was all about Mandela and Clinton the first time around.
Well, speaking of Nelson Mandela, he turned 91 in July. What is his role in South Africa today?
Well, he's retired from public life. He is an old man. He's had a tough life. Of course, he remains hugely important, not just as a symbolic figure. Every time he says something in public, it's picked up on and everyone looks at it for what he really thinks about what's going on at the moment in South Africa. But he tries to avoid getting overly involved. I think people here love him and are all really hoping that he can continue for as long as possible, because Nelson Mandela is not just a great man for South Africa, he's become an icon around the world.
A delicate question, and one I'm sure with no answer, but maybe some speculation. Is there a sense that he will be able to be on the world stage, for a long time?
Well, he's not really on the world stage now. People go and visit him in his home here in Johannesburg. He doesn't make speeches anymore. But at the moment, he seems to be able to continue with what is quite a busy routine of meeting people. But he is a man of 91, so he is frail.
The BBC's Jonah Fisher speaking to us from Johannesburg. Jonah, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
And a quick program note. Next week, we're going to have a story about the first woman to swim the English Channel. An American. We'll have the story of Gertrude Ederle next week. And it's also the history of swimming. Quite fascinating. That's next week. Stay here. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Let's hear from you. We received many of your thoughts after our segment on bullying. We spoke with Serdina Walker of Springfield, Massachusetts. Her 11-year-old son, Carl, committed suicide after relentless bullying at his school. We heard from a mother in Hickory, North Carolina, who didn't want her name used but sent her sympathy and this caution. She writes, "Our daughter attempted suicide and thankfully failed. We learned she'd been harassed unmercifully through texting, MySpace, and email, and no one knew. We've now eliminated the cell phone altogether and watch the screen anytime she's online. This might seem radical, but we are fighting for our child's life. Get between your child and secret technology." We also spoke in that segment with Dr. Robert Sege of Boston Medical Center, who says pediatricians and schools have to teach kids that bullies are the ones with the problem and then get them help. Well, Kathy Galt of Athens, Ohio writes, "That's not easy." She says, "When my children tried to point out bullying of others, they were told they shouldn't tell on other kids." And Jack Ferguson of San Antonio, Texas, disagreed with the thinking that bullies need help. He writes, "It is a crime and can only be effectively controlled through criminal charges. Anything less will continue to result in suffering." Well, on yesterday's show, we spoke about the upcoming summit in Washington on distracted driving, at which the advocacy group, the Center for Auto Safety, says they'll push for a ban on texting while driving. But Howard Hoisington of Yukon, Oklahoma, had a different idea. Howard, you say we should use the GPS systems on cell phones to do what?
To simply cut the cell phone or the PDA, cut it off when the GPS system computes you going any more than 3, 4, 5 miles an hour.
And I think I see by your email, are you in the Air Force?
Well, I work for the Department of Defense at an Air Force base, yes.
So do you think that this technology really can be made to do this?
Yeah, it's a simple mathematics. And as soon as the GPS computes a certain number, it tells the iPod or the PDA to go to standby.
Well, now, okay, this raised some questions. Perhaps a good thought, because that would mean, of course, people might be driving and using their cell phone. But what if they're in the passenger seat, or what if they're on a train?
The messages could be stored, and as soon as the train stops, the cell phone would come back up, and you get all the messages you had 20 minutes ago.
Your point is that you don't want to see any regulations or any laws or any finger-pointing.
There's no amount of ink you can put on any piece of paper that's going to stop someone from doing exactly what they want to do. We still write tickets for running stop signs.
Well, Howard Hoisington, who knows if your idea will be put in the pot. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Finally, we reported recently on fallen troops coming home, their caskets passing through a small town in Britain or transferred to loved ones at Dover Air Force Base here in Delaware. Many of you said you had to pull over to the side of the road. Well, Matthew Temple of Nashville, Tennessee, also had written a song for fallen troops. We're going to play a little here and direct you to his website at ours, hereandnow.org.
So beat the drum slowly and play the fife lowly. Lay me to rest at the break of the dawn.
Then well, we'd love to hear from you. You can just click on Contact Us to send an email or call. We read and listen to everything. Or you can just scroll down the homepage and leave a comment right there. That's hereandnow.org.
I would not have left her for the arms of another, for glory, adventure, or the promise of gold. But my country had called me to fight for her freedom, like so many young men will never grow old.
Well, for weeks, the film and food worlds have been buzzing about Julie and Julia, director Nora Ephron's new movie in which legendary actress Meryl Streep embodies food icon Julia Child, and rising star Amy Adams plays Julie Powell, an almost 30-something who decides to make all the recipes in Mastering the Art of French Cooking and then blog about it in the hopes of adding some joie de vivre to her own life. In this scene, Julie tells her husband about the impact Julia Child's book had on her and her family.
When I was 8, my father's boss came to dinner, and it was a really big deal. And my mother made bouffe bourguignon. But it wasn't just bouffe bourguignon. It was Julia's bouffe bourguignon. And it was like she was there, like Julia was there in the room on our side, like some great, big, good fairy. And everything was going to be all right.
The film has both Julie and Julia, and so for a review, we need both Ty and Kathy, two critics from the Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Ty, nice to see you as always.
Great to be here, Robin.
And here now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Kathy, good to see you as well.
Great to see you too.
And I'm going to start by asking you both, start with you, Kathy, just overall your reaction to the film.
2 hours of pure fun. Meryl Streep blew me away. I loved it. But the best supporting actor or actress is butter.
Okay.
We'll get into that.
All right. And Ty, as a film, what do you think?
I think as a film, it works wonderfully. As you know, it's divided into two parts, and you alternate between Julia Child in 1950s France and Julie Powell in modern-day Queens. And the scenes with Meryl Streep are just miraculous, and Stanley Tucci as her husband. The warmth, the joy in just their being together and their relationship and the joy she takes in cooking is just so palpable.
Let's continue to remind ourselves these two stories that are in the film. One is based on Julie Powell's book about cooking her way through Julia Child's classic, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Julie Powell's book was Julie and Julia. And then there's also Julia Child's book, My Life in France, which she co-wrote with her grandnephew, Alex Prudhomme. And it tells the real-life story of how she was married to Paul Child, as you said, Ty, a diplomat played by Stanley Tucci, and how early on she was at loose ends and needed to find something to occupy her time.
I saw a notice on the bulletin board at the embassy for hat-making lessons.
You like hats?
I do.
What is it that you really like to do?
Eat. I like to do.
I know. And you're so good at it. Look at you. Now,
growing in front of you.
And Kathy, of course, Julia Child ends up at the Cordon Bleu cooking school. There's books, TV shows. Just do you think the film gets across her impact on the world of food?
I think that gets across her impact as a human, her cadence. Meryl Streep just embodies her. She had something in her shoes to give her this incredible height. Julia Child was 6 feet. I mean, she was a gigantic woman, and her impact on the food world continues to be enormous. She let people understand that there was more to food than pot roast and hamburgers. She broke barriers for women, but for all Americans in terms of what was acceptable to try in their kitchens, that French food wasn't this exotic, off the, you know, table kind of thing, that we could really start eating it and cooking it, and that it wasn't difficult.
Even though we've been hearing from vegetarians who are appalled at how Julia would, you know, fling carcasses around. Well, film critic Ty Burr says Julie and Julia ranks up there with Babette's Feast and Like Water for Chocolate, two other wonderful food-based movies. We're going to have more with Ty and Chef Kathy Gunst in just 1 minute, here and now.
I'm Julia Child. Bon appétit.
That, of course, is Meryl Streep playing Julia Child in the new film Julie and Julia. We've been speaking with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr and here now resident chef Kathy Gunst about the film, which tells of Julia Child's discovery of her love of cooking and how she put together the book Mastering the Art of French Cooking with Simone Beck and Louisette Bertol. But it's also the story of Julie Powell, played by Amy Adams, who blogs about her attempts to recreate the recipes from the book. Now, Kathy Gunst, Sometimes she's successful, sometimes not. Let's listen.
I'm sure you all remember, because it was only a few days ago, that I had a meltdown over my aspic and vowed to transform myself into a better human being. And then I was trussing the poulet rôti à la Normande, which is roast chicken stuffed with chicken livers and cream cheese, and it fell on
Damn
the
it.
Floor and the stuffing fell out into
Damn
a big
it.
Gooey mess.
What am I doing?
So, long story short, another meltdown.
Crazy!
Worse than the last.
Can't even trust.
So first of all, have you ever had a meltdown like that? You're so good. We've watched you. Have you ever really, now time to confess.
Listen, it's ugly when you spend hours shopping for a meal, beautifully preparing it, and something goes wrong. Yes.
No, really, what have you ruined?
I've overcooked things. I've undercooked things. I've oversalted things. I mean, we're all human beings. But the food in this movie is so beautiful to look at. The stylist did a fabulous job. I mean, we see chocolate cakes and poached eggs and artichoke with hollandaise. Do not make the mistake that I did. I went to this movie without having dinner. And let me tell you, popcorn doesn't cut it.
No,
when you're looking at food
no.
this exquisite.
There's a scene where Julie's husband, played by Chris Messina, just literally sticks his face in a chocolate cake just because it's so good looking. And everybody in the audience wishes they could be in his
right.
seat.
And what about Amy Adams? We talked about Meryl Streep. What a surprise. She embodies, you know, the character
Perfectly.
She's supposed to embody. But Amy Adams, I know you're a fan of her. I'm a fan of her work. Tell us a little bit about her work past and how you think she did here.
Well, you know, she's been a rising actress in both independent films and in, you know, Disney. She was in Enchanted, and that was sort of where she broke through, and she was in Doubt with Streep. Ironically, they don't get to act, you know, in the same room or the same frame here. But I think she has the tougher job in that she has to portray a realistic modern woman who is sometimes not very appealing, and sometimes her worship of Julia goes a little far. And I think the consensus, the sort of common consensus on the movie, is that the scenes with Streep are just absolutely divine, and you kind of have to sit through the ones with Adams to get to those. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think they complement each other really well. I think what Streep does is really remarkable in that I don't think that she gives us the real Julia Child. I think what she does is she takes the contours of that icon, that caricature that we know, and fills it out and fleshes it out into a real human character.
Well, she performs what is probably one of Julia Child's most famous moments from the television show The French Chef, as Amy Adams as Julie watches on television. So let's listen to Streep as Julie does.
When you flip anything, you've just got to have the courage of your convictions, especially if it's a loose sort of mass, like, oh, that didn't go very well. But you see, when I flipped it, I didn't have the
She's
courage
so adorable.
I needed to, the way I should have. Oh. But you can always put it together. And you're alone in the kitchen. Who's to see?
That's in front of millions of people.
Mm-hmm. But we've reprised here a recent conversation with Julia Child and people in the Boston area. She was very accessible. You know, people got to meet her and talk to her. One thing that was always notable about her is that she was incredibly humble and she was incredibly gracious and nice. What did she in real life think about Julie Powell cooking through her book and blogging about it?
We don't actually know that much. There is a very quick scene in the film where after Julie Powell's blog really hits and all these reporters want to interview her, a reporter called her at home and said, "Have you heard Julia Child hates your blog?" And there was never a confrontation, and the scene just alludes to some discomfort for Julie Powell. But as far as I know, we never really learn what she really thought of it.
And I almost wish the film had gone deeper into that. It sort of tarnishes this hero worship in an interesting way, and the Julie character has an interesting reaction. And it's the one moment where the two halves of the film almost come together and just sort of brush against each other and throw up some interesting sparks. And the movie's getting long at that point, but I wish it had gone into that a little further.
Right. Well, and Ty, you say Meryl Streep sort of takes the contours of the real Julia Child and watercolors them in this film.
Oh, uses oil paints, I think.
Okay. Well, but still, is that the way to know Julia, or do you still only know her really by watching the old, you know, the reruns of The French Chef? because this is what generations going on are going to think is Julia Child.
I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. I took my daughters, 12 and 14, to see this movie, and they're big Meryl Streep fans. I have this sense that she's a huge star to them, to many age groups, which is really unusual. But they came out of it wanting to read the cookbook. And my wife was like, we don't have the cookbook. Maybe we should go get it. I think Julie and Julia, the book about writing the blog, is going to sell well. I think the cookbook is going to fly off the shelves.
Well, in fact, Kathy, you tell an anecdote.
I had a funny story. I was at a horse show last week, and there was a woman sitting in a golf cart with the thick volume of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, the original Bible, sitting there reading it page by page. And I cracked up, and I said, good reading? And she goes, well, I'm going to see the movie next week, and I really wanted to read the book before I went. And it's like, this is not a novel. I said, what are you up to? Lobster Thermidor? I mean, it was hilarious. So Julie Powell has a very tough job. Amy Adams has a tough job. They're both up against giants, the actress of our time and a legendary historical figure. Having, a secretary from Queens write a book about redoing someone's life is a stretch. And in a way, I thought what Nora Ephron did was really interesting, merging the two stories, because I don't think it would have been enough on its own.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But one interesting thing about the movie is that it is a movie about two women publishing books. And somehow it makes that not only interesting, but rather fascinating.
And they both have really good marriages, which is a really unusual thing in movies, particularly summer movies.
This is actually a really good date movie, because guys come off looking great in this movie.
One of my favorite lines is they were at a celebration. Paul Child, Stanley Tucci, holds up his wine glass and makes a toast to his wife, Julia Child.
Julia, you are the butter to my bread and the breath to my life. I love you, darling girl.
And this is France. There's no higher compliment. Bread and butter are the ingredients. They loved each other so much. The romance, I was touched. I teared up a few times, which doesn't take much.
No, there you go. One last question. You've both said you think that this movie is going to get people buying the book again, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. But in a way also, Ty, isn't this a nod to a time that's past? We can't use butter and make beef whatever that was.
Bourguignon.
As much, because we know now it's killing us. All the heart and health questions.
Yeah, but you can have it every once in a while.
That
you
was
don't
what
have
she
to
used to say.
Yeah.
She used to say in moderation.
And look at that character, whether you're looking at Meryl Streep or you're remembering Julia Child through the old clips. This was a happy woman. And I got to tell you, all that good food had a lot to do with it.
That's Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Also, we've been speaking with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. We needed both of them to review the new film, Julie and Julia. Ty, Kathy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bon appetit.